Now, today particularly, I think we ought to be able to make headway, because in most instances, you'll have everything in your book. Just a matter of clarifying, or if you're thinking of an exception, and there are plenty, as you know, in this business, how you might meet up with it. Talking about direct quotations, the ordinary short quotation, three lines or less, is just kept, embodied into the text. If you want to look at page G, you have a few examples of this, or an example of that, I should say, in the back. And then if you look at H, you'll have also the longer one. We use the block. And as you know, that if you use the block itself stands for the quotation mark. And therefore, an in quote is a, you use then a double quote, and for, if you have a second in quote, then actually the single in quote. This is one place where you change the original quotation, because he will have an in quote, or rather he would have a, this is where he would not. But in if there is any question, is shifting over, you can change his quotation marks, because actually you're not changing it, since the rule applies that the block takes care of the first direct quotation mark. The hand up there, you want a question?
Yes. When you say, for example, you begin a paragraph, and you have just a couple of words introducing the quote, now this is, all right, this is what the thing you indented, it'll be the same indentation as the footnote there.
Oh. Yeah, you mean the beginning of the paragraph?
Yes.
Yeah, like I have. Mm-hmm. Five spaces. Mm-hmm. Notice on the bottom, correct use of quotation marks. The commas and periods should be placed within the closing quotation marks, semicolons and colons without. This is simply a type rule that is generally agreed. However, if the quotation that you're taking it doesn't follow this rule, because there are variations, you remain with the original. Again, this is where you can violate a typing rule if the original violated a typing rule. If it bothers you, as I had a student yesterday looking at his paper, fourth year research paper, he felt this bothered him a little bit, so he had to put the word sick in there, thus. Well, it's not that important that you call my attention to the fact that I didn't do this, and that was in the original. Then you can get, by the use of the SIC, you get a little pedantic that every time there's something a little out of line, you've got to put a sick down. You only use that procedure if it's a serious thing, serious violation, like a spelling error, and that isn't even too important, but an error in date or name or something like that. You don't want to be held responsible. Yes, sir?
The last line of the first paragraph in the direct quotation is paragraphs within the direct quotation are separated by double space. No indentation again in the second paragraph, is that correct?
No.
Say you're on page 14 in the quotation.
Yeah.
One direct quotation is the first paragraph, the last line.
Paragraph. Yeah.
Coming to your second paragraph, you skip the space, I understand.
That's
that.
Right.
You still go out to the end in block form, you don't indent in the second paragraph.
No, block form.
Block
yeah.
Form.
Mm-hmm. That's not what you asked before, though, was it? No, I didn't think so. Okay. Indirect quotations, well, there's nothing there except that you have to give your source with a superscript, and how that is indicated, you can see from the text, this is not very difficult. One thing I do want to call your attention to, though, is that all enumerations and abbreviations alike that you've made in, say, chapter 2, you have to pick it up in chapter 3 as though it were a new chapter again, a new section, rather. So superscripts start with number 1 again. You don't run through the whole manuscript. Number 2, if you have abbreviated, look at that in a moment, if you have abbreviated something, or an upset referring to a previous article which you referred to in the previous chapter, that must be repeated. The full information given again. The idea being that each chapter should be an independent unit, that you can simply lift it out and say, here it is. If you have a reference to a previous chapter, obviously the fellow wouldn't know what you're talking about because he can't get the original source. Ellipses, I think we covered that pretty well when we talked about it in a previous occasion, so let me skip that. Footnotes, likewise, is fairly simple of where they are. They're separated from the text by an unbroken line 1.5 inches long or 15 spaces, drawn from the left-hand margin, one double space below the last line of the text. Footnotes are not only references to the sources, this is the usual thing, but they can also take care of any editorial remarks you want to make, any reference to a previous part of the thesis, or something which is still coming up. If it is too long, say a page or two, then obviously it qualifies as an appendix rather than as a footnote. After all, the appendix is nothing much more than that. For term papers, we have one and short research reports which do not concern you for the moment. The footnotes may be placed at the end of the paper or the report. Page 17, yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. Well, now, again, you have footnotes. It's a new section. That particular one is not, the first one is not numbered. It's counted, but not numbered. The second page of your footnote, which will not have a heading, that will be, the number will appear. See, it's the same rule, just the same thing with the bibliography. Anything. It's the same category. All right, now the form, you remember, when we talked about bibliography, we said there were three basic facts. Could be more, but there had to be at least three. The author, the title, and the publication information. Now, if you supply the same material for the first footnote that you have in the bibliography, but now it's a footnote, a note, and therefore it is not, you don't use a period. Usually, the period is now replaced by a comma. I'm trying to give you the picture of why it's different. So, and obviously, the name of the author is reversed. It's normal way. Not a period, comma, and now, in general, the same rules apply. But to have it spelled out on page 17, because there are always a number of exceptions, for instance, when it's edited by somebody and the like, here is the usual procedure. If everything is needed, and of course this is rarely the case, author's name with Christian name or initials first, followed by a comma. Next, title, underlined, you're italicizing it, followed by a comma, except when there is a parenthesis following. This is a typing rule, this is not a thesis rule. For instance, if for some reason or other here you've got to put a parenthesis, as you often do, then this one falls out and comes in after here, after this. But this is just plain typing rule and shouldn't be confused, but it's a required regulation. Then the name of editor or translator, when you've got that. The following items are now enclosed in parentheses. And you see the parentheses will normally follow the title. Unless you've got something like editor or somebody coming in between. And this material, namely the number of the edition when necessary, second or revised edition, followed by a semicolon, place of publication followed by a colon, publisher followed by a comma, date of publication, period, parenthesis closed, parenthesis closed, comma, and then you go on. The volume number, when you've got one, followed by a comma, and notice just the number, page number followed by a period. If there is no volume cited, the letter or letters, P or double P, precede the page numbers. So actually, it's the same as we've been talking about, except that you bear in mind you're talking about a footnote, and therefore the commas predominate. Simply for the convenience of your reader, that you don't require him to go back and forth. He may want to know who this fellow is, what year is publication, how valid is this, what you're saying. There's no other reason than that. On the other hand, you know, not everything that's in the bibliography appears in the footnote. Again, to make it a single, self-contained item. If the chapter's torn out, the bibliography isn't there. Well, I think these, in general, all the rules are pretty well illustrated. The simplest one is the one with Paul Veith. The next one is a slightly more complicated because you have an editor in there. The third one is still more complicated because it's a book in a series. But you notice again, it's you editorialize, comma, in the American history, the church history series. And then Lewis Sherrill, that's different again because you're indicating that it's revised edition, Richmond, Virginia, and the like. So you have, in general, the four large categories from which to draw. Please.
If the book is not designated, in what city the book was published,
No, you usually put out the one that's slowly the, but you think, if you know what the home office is, you'll take that one. If not, you take the American one. That's not really important. I mean, don't worry about it, but don't put them all in. It's the largest city, normally, in which it's the home office, but obviously this is not always it's true. But it's often the first one is the home office. But it's not always, you have to be careful. So it doesn't really make any difference. Because actually, you see, the person can, even the second or the third, where maybe only a station, Java's outlet and the like, they call it their secondary home. If you went to that city, you'd find it, it'd be available there. All right? Now, this is for books. Now, periodicals in general, it's the same rule, but because there are more exceptions, the exception is probably more common. You'll notice again, author's name with Christian name, initial, same thing. Title of article in quotation marks, bottom page 17. That's the same thing, followed by a comma. Title of periodical underlined, followed. Remember, the name of the periodical is the name of the book. Concordia Theological Monthly, that's the name of the book. That's how it would be classified as a periodical. Then the volume number, the year. Sometimes month and year, or month, date and year, depending how it's listed. Enclosed in parentheses, followed by a comma, then page number, followed by a period. Now, in practically every instance, there's a volume attached to it. Therefore, in practically every instance, you do not use the P or double P. And you don't say 728 FF if it happens to be more than two or three pages. You go, now you're throwing the burden on the reader. How far did you... are you including in this quotation? Sort of taking unfair advantage of it, because either if he doesn't find it in the first two or three pages, he never knows, well, did you fake it? Or do I have to read to the end of the book to find out where this really comes up? And it's a good way of faking, incidentally, when it's really what you mean, not FF, but you mean possum, here and there. It's several places. So give him specific information. Even the F today. In other words, simply 728F, which normally means 728 and 729, is not considered good form. And therefore, we have eliminated it also. Publishing houses usually strike it out in a hurry. Okay? Ernest, any questions? And incidentally, I got caught on this one time in a lengthy article. Well, really, it was a book. And I had always put FF because it's what I was accustomed to. And I began to realize why it was so important that you give the terminal place. Because as I try to find out where I terminated, because I had to be sure that I got the whole thing, I had to always read two or three pages beyond the place that I had originally meant. Because I wanted to be sure I got the terminal point. And now I was in the position of the reader who was trying to check up. And you get just like when you're in the pew, you can be much more sympathetic to the laity than when you're in the pulpit. Yes, sir.
If you have a case like quotation from theological monthly here, 728 and
Not 9. That's always considered bad. 29 sometimes is accepted. But again, this is one of the things where, for the sake of accuracy, the whole thing should be in there, 729. Repeat the entire number. It's because numbers are the trickiest things for you to make mistakes on. No proofreader can catch the mistake except when it goes back to the original. This is another embarrassing thing when you have to go back later on and look up some quote that you're not sure whether you quoted correctly, and then find that you made a type error in the original. You see, if you make this type error when you first put it down, it simply stays in there. There's nowhere you'll ever catch it again, because it makes sense whether it's 728 or 729. And this is probably the cause of more problems in publication or in writing when the original, someone goofed on the footnote or the page reference. And this is less likely, it'll keep you a little more honest in an academic sense rather than a moral sense. Yes, sir?
If it's just one page, it isn't proper to put a comma in between.
No.
I
won't say it's not proper. It's done. But we have not. Now, there's another thing I wanted to indicate. I think someone asked this once before. Say it's 728. Which means that the article is basically here, then it's continued on page 812.
This is a continuation of it.
Is that correct?
Yes, this is correct. Yeah. Now, you'll have that often in more popular magazines where they try to crowd all the major articles in the front, you know, and then give the continuation part in the second part of the magazine. Same thing, of course, is true when you go over several issues. Then you should put semicolon.
You know, if it's in the January number here, and in the February number, it's then, of course, it'll have to indicate it up here, January and dash February.
In the February number, they check three numbers. Is this three numbers again?
Doesn't make a difference because you've got a second. Now, it normally would not happen except when you go from a December to a January, because volumes usually don't break. Then, of course, you've got to put down one and two, volumes two and three, or as some do, begin in September. That's not quite correct. Conquest our quarter begins in April.
That's right. You can break it. For instance, the previous number might be the same year, but this is what will happen. Whatever's first will refer to the first volume and so on.
Mm-hmm. This can happen when you cross volumes, particularly. Usually it doesn't happen otherwise.
Bible references in the footnotes. Remember, there are no abbreviations normally in the body. Any abbreviation should be in the footnote. I say normally because there are a few which will be referred to in a moment. And this is the way they are. Notice the different combinations. The same thing applies to the apocryphal books, titles of ancient manuscripts, and the like. Classical and patristic authors, similarly, this is quite difficult at times. Such authors are cited according to book, and that's usually with a lowercase. The next is the section, and that's followed by a period, and then the paragraph number, the paragraph number. So this means book 4, section 2, paragraph numbers 14. Yes, sir, someone had a hand back there, please.
Is there
Yes, they're in here. I think, yes, on page 28. Oh, you have the old edition there. Yeah, 28. But I don't think you, this is not a major problem, really. Yes, sir?
I have a question about the punctuation of biblical references in section C of page 18. Then period separating like it, the Galatians reference would be chapter 3, verse 1 and 5 would be a period.
This is correct. There are several ways of doing it, but you finally have to decide on one.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm not saying the other's wrong, but it's just one of these arbitrary deals. You decide on this one. Yes? You're right. You're perfectly correct. I don't know whether the one is older or another. That I'm not saying that. Please.
What's the page that
is biblical reference? 20A. Yeah. A, not H. Yes, sir. Well, in the footnote the first time. Now that's all you have to worry about, because theoretically, at least, all the good editions break it down into the same sections. They're not always true, but theoretically, I say. But that's why you protect yourself in indicating what edition you're using in the final analysis, that you're only responsible to that.
Of each chapter,
yes. Folios, where there's no pagination, these are all troublemakers, as you well know, refer to the number of the folio together with letters of the alphabet, lowercase, and so on. For example, folio 76A or folio 101C. Try to find out from the folio that you're using what is the more proper one.
Letters from boxes.
Simply put it that contained in box 64 or whatever it is, that's all you can do. Yeah, that's good. Of course, they're usually numbered. And since you're indicating the source, that's all you need to do. So that the historical institute gets to be sort of like the publisher.
How do you treat a
track? Not as a published item with a title, underlined. Now, what part are you talking about the title itself, or are you talking about publisher? Or date and so on? Well, you'll need just treat it like a book. Now, unfortunately, most of the material or information is not there. So simply say no date, no publisher. ND, period. Don't just omit it or ignore it because it's not there. Because you'll be faulted, why don't you give it to me? So you're telling me, when you put down no date, how can I?
You know that it isn't correct?
No. You only do that if, you may do it. But you, you know what I'm going to say. I slipped my mind, I don't know what I want to tell you about it. Oh, yes, whenever you have an annotated bibliography, then you indicate it. Of course, that's obvious. Now, it's good to put it in parentheses, tracked, but it's not required. This is, if it's partially annotated, where you indicate the pages, so a person can tell, well, the four pages obviously are tracked. Now, if you're dealing with a number of them, I think this might be a certain help to an individual, because he may be running around looking for a book. And here it's only a four-page deal, which might be important depending on the type of paper you're writing. Exegetical paper, chances are, is very unimportant. But if it's something with a very controversial thing, a polemic, it can be a very important keystone. I'm sure you know the general rules about when ibid is to be used. However, only is permissible when it refers back to the same work by the author. And if you bear in mind, ibid is the same thing as ditto. You cannot use ibid when you're referring back to an article, to a work which has been since then intercepted, so to speak, by another work. Because ibid always refers to the one that's immediately above it, even though it's 10 pages above it. But there must be nothing, no foreign book in between. Later references, you use, we're trying to get away from the, well, we are getting away from the upset, as you'll notice. Simply use the author's title, or author's name rather, V, page 17. if there are more than one by the same author, you have an example there, Coverley Readings, Coverley History. The volume is given, or even though the earlier reference is from the same volume, to make sure that that the reader understands. Yes, sir?
Going back to something that you just mentioned before, on annotated bibliography, when is that given and what's it?
Only if you desire to do so or your advisor requires it. A certain type of thing. Normally it's not done. Or I would say it's less common. I wouldn't say it's wrong. No, it's a very valuable thing. But it's really because it's so laborious, so to speak, to do the thing. You can do it with a number, but once you do it, you've got to be consistent to all of it. It's very important when you have a polemical deal, some controversial thing, you want to know who's pro and who's con. It's a valuable addition, but it's one of those things you can dispense with if you can get by with it without doing it. Well, supra, infra, I'm sure you know those. These are things, of course, you can't always type out until you're finished. Passum or possum merely means that you're not being held to a specific section. It merely means this is what the author sort of lives and breathes. That's his theory, and you'll see that almost every page. Possum, here and there. Or it means also on page 20 that you have used, say, Lutheran Education, volumes 50, no, this is 84 to 90. You haven't read every article in those four or five volumes, but you have generally examined them and therefore simply put down possum. This is a little open door, so if someone says, well, wait a minute, you've missed one, well, okay, I missed one. I didn't tell you I reviewed them all. You give yourself a little opening, that's all. Abbreviations of longer titles of books, translations, and the like, when they get to be pretty laborious, you may simply use, for instance, like this one on John Chrysostom, you use a lot of his books, and to avoid all the specific references, you simply indicate hereafter will be referred to as MPG. And then you see under the footnote how it appears. Simply say Matthew, homily. It means the commentary on Matthew, homily 11 in the Patrologia. And there are other ones here. Walter Bauer. By the way, let me call your attention that we, in our own circles, this is to show how provincial we are, we talk about the Arndt Genrich. That's not the proper title. It's the Walter Bauer, don't forget. The Arndt Genrich are merely the translators and editors. And therefore, it should be referred to as the Walter Bauer, not as the Arndt Genrich. Luther's works. Standard edition is the Weimar WA, that usually takes care of it. Capital Roman numerals refers to volume, lowercase Roman refers to the part, Arabic number refers to page. And now here are the abbreviations which are permitted in the text. There are very few. The common ones are there. Also, exact references. In other words, you're talking about Paul in 1 Corinthians never argues this way. You can't put down Paul in 1 COR, period, doesn't argue this way. You got to write that out. But when you make an exact reference, Paul argues in 1 Corinthians 15:4, then you may abbreviate it. Because in one case, you're really talking about a title of the book or an epistle, and the other one, you're talking about a specific reference. So exact references from the Bible, the Apocrypha, titles of ancient manuscripts and symbols used for biblical manuscripts, these may be abbreviated in the text. Yes, sir?
I noticed in several books nowadays that the period is got from things like doctor and mister, and that's
described. I'm not aware of it.
Uh-huh.
Right, is it? Mm-hmm. Could be. It's one of those things again. 28 gives you footnotes, the different abbreviations and footnotes, and generally speaking, you can use almost any standard one. And here they are. This is nothing peculiar to theses. The use of numbers, ordinarily numbers under 100, should be spelled out. Except, of course, in statistical connection when you're using tables and the like. There are exceptions. Round numbers, even over 100, are written out. Dates, page numbers, decimal percentage, and sums of money appear as figures. Page 21, there is one change. This is, we had to put this in there because we contradict ourselves with 21. A, the word percent should be written out. That's perfectly correct. But it also may be written as one word without the space. So you make that change if you please. Foreign words, this is always a troublemaker. Foreign words are always italicized, that is underlined, except when the entire quotation is in a foreign language. Foreign titles, institutions, and the like are not underlined. When the title of a book is given in a foreign language, such information as revised edition, fourth edition, may be given in that language, though a translation is usually preferred. Either way is possible. But the translation usually is preferred, especially if it is a word that looks a little different in the English, like, I don't know which one, Brunvigio for Braunschweig, and, what was the one for Florence? I know that my son and Dr. Fierbringer's son went to Italy and bypassed the city and didn't realize it was Florence. They were looking for Florence. So some of these names should be translated, perhaps. Vienna Wien. But this is entirely up to you. Only be consistent. Do not underline standard abbreviations from the foreign language, such as EG. They have so become Americanized that we consider them English words now. Prepositions which are part of a family name are written as the person name has determined. That's difficult because you usually find this answer, in a regular biographical dictionary. There's no reason why Henry Van Dyke is capital V and Hugo de Grun is a small d. This is simply what they have chosen to do. Germans, the same thing. Proper names with prefixes are usually indexed. Oh, right, this is another one. The proper names with prefixes are usually indexed under the prefix, except in the case of German names. In other words, Debari would be under D, von Hindenburg is under H. Now we see we're borrowing the rules of the various countries, languages, and it's their rule. Division of words and typing, efforts should be made to make the right-hand margins even as possible. Care should be taken that proper divisions are made. Avoid double hyphenation of a word if there already has a hyphen. And then don't put another one in as you break the word. For hyphenations, here again, arbitrarily, Webster's 7th New Intercollegiate Dictionary is the standard authority. Exceptions may be made in the case of long foreign proper names, particularly in German. Now, here are the following words. Now, here's a misprint. I don't know if it's corrected in yours or not. Or I shouldn't say misprint. It's an error in our office in typing. 21A. The following words, comma, formerly two words and hyphenated, comma, are now compounded and properly written as one word. Now, those of you who have the older edition don't have this. And this is simply a change that has now taken place. These all at one time were hyphenated words. And that's where that percent came in, and we had to change our rule because of the, this would have been contradiction with on page 21A. Then such things as indentations, just a matter of reading it. Simplified spelling is not acceptable. Enumeration in text is important. How do you do when you have several parts and you want to enumerate something in the text? You enclose the figure or the letter, whichever you prefer to use, in parentheses, and they are not separated by periods. So it's merely parentheses open, A, parentheses closed, and B, C, D. No line and the like. However, if you want to list of the enumeration on page 22, here you have a different procedure. There is A, period, a recognition of the peculiar characteristic and so on. Don't forget the, a dash on a typewriter comprises two hyphens. It's not important as a rule because you don't use it often, but when you use it in our circles, you almost have to because our official name has a dash in it. So let's all learn at least how to write our own name properly. And please, as a one-man member of a committee for the preservation of Synod's name, it's the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, and not Lutheran Church in America, of Missouri Synod. Don't forget the. This is not true of Lutheran Church in America. They start with the letter L. We start with the letter T. Let's keep it that way. That is, as long as it's official. When Synod changes something else, let's follow suit then. But until that time, let's keep it the way it's supposed to be. Then the typing mechanics. Pica is preferred, although a lead is permitted. A lead is sometimes nice to look at, except for carbons. If you're making carbons, a lead can be really a nuisance. And that's the only reason I imagine most universities require pica. They won't give you the choice. But today, you know, oftentimes second copies are Xeroxed, and therefore this isn't quite so important anymore. Paper, this is important. Have a good quality paper. Very small expenditure considering all the time you're putting in. Paper should have at least 50% rag content. This is one of the prices we pay for modern life. Many papers today already are becoming yellow and we didn't insist on it. And in cases where they even use the very inferior type of paper, it's beginning to get brittle. Actually, the rule should be, it should be 90% to 100% rag content. I understand that if you get your second copy Xeroxed, it'll be done on 100% rag paper. And that will then become the copy on reserve or in the archives, and your first copy will be circulated because it'll be that much more valuable. That's only those for those who get theirs Xerox. Yes, sir. No. I say normally pica is insisted, but we have permitted up to now pica or elite. However, not script or any of these fancy scrolls. It gets pretty tiresome to read 50, 60, 100 pages in this beautiful but illegible material. Don't forget, paper should be punched three holes for easy assembly. It'll save you some headaches, too, because they are to be put into a binder, and therefore also naturally have to be punched. And so that while the paper is being, your thesis is being read and processed and finally bound, it doesn't have that tragedy which could easily happen where two or three are piled up on a desk, you know, and somebody comes along and everything goes on the floor. That has happened, especially when they are collected in the library and you get 50, 60, 70 of these theses and you don't want to put them all one at a time. You know, you gotta put them on top of one another. And at one time, this did happen. And it was quite a, many hours were spent and lost in reassembling them. Corrosible and irascible bond or similar easily erasable paper is not acceptable under no circumstances. This is very poor paper for theses. First of all, most people don't know how to run it properly through the rollers and the like, and it gets to be very smudgy. The very thing which makes it so nice, namely you erase so easily, also makes it smudgeable very quickly, especially second copies. And if you have anything defective in your typewriter, that roller will show through And don't ruin all the work just because it's easy to erase from it. Now, if you know how to, there's some people who are experts at using it, and I understand some of this. I don't know whether it's corrasible or erasable. Actually, the type fastens in it, sort of eats its way in, so to speak, and it is very good. But until that happens, about a week or 10 days later, it's very susceptible to any kind of finger marking. And remember, this goes to the reader and the advisor and the thesis secretary, and this could take its toll by the time it's ready for binding, even though it came perfect out of your hands. So these are not acceptable. Yes, sir?
Can we use that when we give our first to the advisor?
Yeah. But there's no particular advantage, though, frankly, for you either, because you can use overstrikes and correct the finger with your pencil, you know, and make any kind of corrections. So there's no advantage from that angle if you just want to have a neater job. No, there's nothing. On first or second copy, you can use any kind of paper. First or second draft, I mean. Yes, sir?
On the final draft, the first copy is required to be turned in.
Two.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, say, like, could you do something like if you use corrasible bond and had two Xerox copies made?
That's all right. Yeah, but you're taking the chance by the time it's accepted and all the advisors signed it, that's only when it's Xeroxed. You wouldn't want to Xerox it before that because there may be some changes made.
In your final.
Yeah. So you wouldn't say you're taking too big a chance.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
This final draft that he's talking about, is that the one that the thesis secretary is, I mean, that you hire somebody to type? I mean, if you're not going to do it yourself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, you can hire someone the first draft. That's why I don't know whether. But usually, normally, you get someone to type your final copy. And while she may know how to handle corrasible paper, once she gives it to you, she's no longer responsible for your fingerprints. Except the FBI may be interested in them, but outside of that. You see? And this is where the trouble begins, often. And then if you would say, well, I'll make this my third copy, the one I'm going to keep, and make a Xerox, the Xerox will also reproduce all the nice smudges. It'll be faithful. So I don't think it gave anything.
When you have a typist like we're talking about, do you wait until everything has been done to your paper till your advisor and reader have finished with it before you give it to the typist, or do they only do their final work after you get it back from your typist?
It goes back both ways. In other words, you give him what you might call what you hope is your semi-final copy. All right, then corrections are made on it. And you make those corrections, and then the typist will type from that. But that final copy is again reviewed. Now, not with the same degree of concern as the first, because there they're looking primarily, did you make the changes? And then there might be some corrections, because in retyping a page, the secretary may have made a new mistake. Please.
Are you able to say a word about how contact is made with the secretary and what procedure is followed in that stuff?
You mean the thesis secretary? Through the director of graduate studies office. And you just leave it there. Mrs. Carmack will see to it that she gets it. It's Mrs. Ryman, by the way, if you want to make direct contact, which is all right, too. But it's the easiest way is to give it to Mrs. Carmack, and then Mrs. Ryman will contact you as a rule, personally, if there are anything beyond what she had to give you in notes. And it's over there. Any questions? I'm trying to finish this if at all possible. I think this will be our last meeting. That's why I'm trying to, I know the bell is rung, but are there still some questions? All right, second copy may be Xerox. Of course, we said this already. Nothing more about ribbon. Sometimes you must change your ribbon. These are just little hints. Don't change your ribbon in the middle of a chapter. You know what happens often. Do it at the beginning of a new chapter. That's not so bad. You must do it. Then it'll be less noticeable if you don't wait until you've gotten the last little ink out of that previous one. Erasures, no corrections in pencil or ink are permitted. Obviously, if you have a type error, you erase it, you make a clean job of correcting it, that's permissible. Rest is all there, centering, pagination, thesis, prospectus. Oh, yes, this is important. Just call your attention to it. But it's there. Just read it. You are to provide your committee with a prospectus for the committee so that they have an idea of what the thesis is about, because not everyone on your committee will read the whole thesis. Not necessarily. You won't have that much time. That's a luxury.
It's all right if you get it done early, but usually you can't. And the three people or the two people responsible, they of course know it, and the rest don't. But now they've got to have some kind of an idea what it's about so they can draft the proper question.